So this is our monster month here at the Fellowship, where we've explored different monsters as a way of having courage in the face of terrible things in our world. And today we are looking at zombies. Zombies are seemingly everywhere in popular culture these days, from the hit TV series The Walking Dead to the parody novel, which was recently turned into a film called Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. But before these, before any of the other zombie books or shows or movies, there was the first American zombie movie in 1938. It starred Bela Lugosi, the actor made famous as Dracula the year before, and it was titled White Zombie. White Zombie is where I want us to focus today, so let me give you a brief synopsis of the movie in case you've never seen it or in case it's been a while. And I warn you, it's a little complicated. The White Zombie is set in Haiti, where an evil Eastern European voodoo master, Bela Lugosi's character, who is named, no kidding, Murder, has an entire sugarcane mill run by Haitians of African heritage, who have all been turned to mindless zombie slaves through his evil voodoo magic. The main character, though, is a white woman named Madeline, who is engaged to marry a man, also white, named Neil. A fourth important character is Charles Beaumont, also white, who hosts Madeline and Neil at his plantation home. But Charles falls secretly in love with Madeline and wants her for himself, of course. He meets with Murder, the voodoo master, and arranges for Murder to turn Madeline into a zombie through the use of a potion that makes her appear to die. Then she is buried, and then she is risen, unbeknownst to Neil, in a zombie state under the control of Murder for Charles's benefit. Over time, Charles regrets the decision to turn Madeline into a zombie, and he asks Murder to reverse the spell, but he won't. Meanwhile, Neil tries to rescue Madeline now that he has become aware of what is going on. In the fight that ensues, Murder, the evil master, is knocked unconscious but not killed, and while he is unconscious, the entire sugar mill of African slave zombies have no one controlling them, and they walk off a cliff to their deaths. But Madeline, who is also under Murder's control, is fine somehow while he is unconscious. And when Murder wakes up, he is eventually pushed off a cliff by Charles, the plantation owner who had Madeline turned into a zombie in the first place. But Charles also loses his balance and also falls to his death. And upon Murder's death, the spell is broken. Madeline wakes up from her zombie state and embraces Neil, who has saved her. The end. Yeah, there is a lot there. So the original zombie stories, the origination of the zombie story comes from Haiti. In folklore that describes bringing the dead back to a half-life, zombies are not infected, nor do they eat brains in Haitian folklore. They are controlled by the person who created them, often through some sort of magic or potion. They are puppet creatures who have no autonomy. In Haitian culture, there are different types of zombies, but something common to each of them is that they are lacking part of their soul. Now, Haiti is a country that saw some of the harshest conditions of the transatlantic slave trade and was the site of a major successful slave rebellion in 1804, in which the enslaved inhabitants overthrew the American, French, and British slaveholders. Zombie myths entered the Western consciousness as a descriptor of the frightening heathen country that Haiti must be, with mindless savages running around without anyone to control them. While the zombie myth itself emerges out of the Haitian culture, scholars often point to the racist uses to which the myth has been put in our culture. One scholarly article that I read even pointed to the physical likeness of a zombie. Scraggly hair, dirty skin, bugged eyes, as itself being a reference to the stereotypical African slave imagery of its time. So today, in the spirit of our monthly theme of practicing courage, we will be using the zombie as a metaphor for talking about the ways in which each of us might be asleep or half awake to the powers that exist in our world and the ways in which those powers control us, zombie-like, against our will. Our goal today is to explore how we might be able to wake up to overcome them. And because of the racist history around the zombie myth, and because today is the second iteration of the Unitarian Universalist white supremacy teach-in, I want to talk to you today about the ways we are asleep, particularly to white supremacy. Now, I've been your senior minister for about 3 months. I've been around for 14 Sundays, including the two in which I was candidating. I've preached at 9 of them, including today. And this will be the third time that I've talked explicitly with you about racism and white supremacy. 1/3 of my sermons have had to deal with this topic. Twice now, because we have been asked by the Black Lives of UU Collective to do the white supremacy teach-in back in April and again today. And we talked about it once because neo-Nazis were marching in the streets with torches. And I've heard about this from you. I've heard you tell me that you love that I'm challenging racism from the pulpit. I've heard members of our people of color group thank me for not shying away from hard topics. I've also heard some of you say that you're tired of hearing political things from the pulpit. I've heard you tell me that you don't necessarily agree with the language of white supremacy. You think it might be off-putting to people who want to do anti-racism work. I hear all of this. I hear you and I acknowledge you. I don't want to talk about white supremacy 1/3 of the time. I don't. But in times of challenge, in times of trouble, and when it seems called for, I will. And when our siblings of color at the national UU level ask us to, I will. And today, I'm talking about white supremacy in a way that hopefully clears up some of the misunderstanding around it. I want people who feel uncomfortable with that word, and it's okay to feel uncomfortable with that word, I want you to hear very clearly that this is not about blame or shame or self-loathing. This is about a system that we, all of us, have been born into by being part of this culture, which long before we were born, long before our nation was even founded, was rooted in an evil system that still to this day has power over us. That we, if left unexamined, will continue to be zombies in its power. And we, all of us, want to break free of that evil power and begin to dismantle it. Again, I want you to hear me very clearly. This is not a sermon about guilt or shame or how we should all beat ourselves up over the sins of our ancestors. This is a sermon about the systems that undergird our society and that, like the zombies of Haitian folklore, these powers of evil have robbed us of part of our soul. As your minister, it's my job to challenge the things in our world that rob us of our capacity for wholeness and life. That's my job. That's what you pay me for. And white supremacy is absolutely a soul-robbing force for all of us. And because I love you, I know we need to do this work. The fact is that our country and the countries that led to ours were all founded by white men who were heterosexual, or at least appearing to be, able-bodied, Christian, and cisgender. For those of you who don't know what that last word means, cisgender, it means identifying as the gender which corresponds with your biology. It's the opposite of transgender. If you don't know what the word means, you probably are cisgender. So not only did those people, those white, heterosexual, able-bodied, Christian, cisgender men found our country, they crafted laws to keep themselves in power. And they did this because they had entire cultural belief systems set up around the idea that they were the smartest, strongest, most moral of all the people. They were needed to keep the others in check. They were needed to control the brown and black people, those savages. They were needed to make decisions for the women, those feeble-minded ones. They were needed to make manifest the destiny of the church to spread the good word to all the godless heathens. Now, I am a universalist, and so I believe in the inherent goodness of all people, which is not always easy. So I don't believe that those people did what they did because they were horrible monsters. I don't believe that. I believe that they thought what they were doing was good and just and right. And for that, I try, on my good days, to forgive some of their actions. But the effect of their actions, built generation upon generation upon generation, is that these pieces of their identities became associated with goodness and morality and intelligence and normativity. Norm. Their identities, white, male, straight, cisgender, Christian, able-bodied, became the norm. It became the identity against which all other identities were measured and always found lacking. When we talk about privilege, this is what we're talking about. If you hold one of the norm identities, you have privilege in this area. And if you are, say, a white, straight woman like me, you might have privilege in some areas, white, straight, but not in others, woman. Privilege is summed up, as the saying goes, your life might be hard if you are white, but your life is not hard because you are white. That is what privilege means. Straight people have never had to fight for their relationships to be culturally or legally validated. Cisgender men don't have to worry about being seen as good leaders at work or ever being called bitchy. Cisgender people don't have to worry about getting kicked out of a bathroom or legally being denied employment or housing. Able-bodied people can always enter a building. These are just a few of the basic, very basic privileges gained only because of the identities we carry, not because of anything we did to earn them. With regard to race, whiteness became the norm for beauty. Lighter skin was and still is often viewed as preferred, especially in women. Straight, smooth hair, too. Only just a few weeks ago, and this is true, only just a few weeks ago, the Dove Soap Company circulated an advertisement that showed a pretty black woman using a Dove product and becoming a white woman. Really, seriously, this stuff is so pervasive that even in 2017, the executives at a company that prides itself on being a model of positivity didn't think, hey, this is actually totally racist. To imply that a black woman is dirty or impure in this way? They received a public outcry, they quickly yanked the ad, they apologized, but the fact remains that this is so incredibly pervasive that that wasn't even noticed? What color are nude tights? Beige. What color are Band-Aids? Beige. And not only is physical whiteness seen as the norm, all of the cultural associations with whiteness are seen as the norm. And this is often where we are most asleep to... This is where we are often most asleep to the powers that control us. It's easy to see the beige Band-Aids and say, oh, wow, maybe I didn't notice that before, but now that I see it, it's obvious to me that whiteness is a norm in our society. But the other stuff, the cultural stuff, is harder to notice. Slide. So this is an iceberg. It's an illustration of an iceberg. And we all know that the top of the iceberg is just a little bit of what constitutes the iceberg. The top is what is visible above the water. It's noticeable. With regard to culture, this is things like dress styles, holidays, food, arts, music. So if you can't read the slide, that's what's above. That's what we can see. And that's what we celebrate when we celebrate things like multicultural days. But the stuff that is invisible, because it's below the water or it's so ingrained in our system that we don't even see it or notice it, are things like the different ways cultures view authority, or eye contact, or conflict, or child rearing. These things are normed on white culture in our society. These are the things that come comfortably or easily to white people. When a teacher says to a student, "Look at me when I'm talking to you," the teacher is demanding a white norm of eye contact and respect. If the student is, say, from an Asian culture and has been taught that respect means averting your eyes from your elders, the student is suddenly confused. They weren't trying to be disrespectful, but now they're being demanded a different behavior. Black and Latino families often, though not always, express joy, anger, and sadness with big displays of feeling. They might yell or wail or cheer. This is their norm. But to the white world, it's seen as too much, too loud, too angry. And teachers, ministers, police officers, and others raised in our white normative society see that display as threatening. And there are real consequences to that. When people in power are normed on a white culture system, we end up with things like higher detention and expulsion rates for children of color, and higher prison rates for people of color, among many other things. So when we talk about white supremacy, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about the idea that whiteness is the norm, both the things above the water and, more importantly, the things that we can't see. And not just the norm, but that whiteness is the model, the goal, the virtue that others should strive for. It's supremacy. Now, I hate to do this in a sermon, but today is the teach-in. So I want you to know the dictionary definition of the word supremacy. It is defined as the state or condition of being superior to all others in authority, power, or status. Synonyms include primacy, authority, and control. That's what that word means. It doesn't necessarily mean being in the Klan. It just means that whiteness is the thing that has the most authority, power, or status in our society, and that's the truth. And whiteness as an idea controls us. The movie White Zombie that I talked about at the beginning is a movie about an evil sorcerer who controls an entire workforce of enslaved African Haitian zombies, who later all plunge to their deaths because they can't think for themselves when their master is knocked unconscious. And this is not the major tragedy of the movie. Just think about that. It's a throwaway plot point. That alone is enough to illustrate the inherent evil of white supremacy. The black characters are not given full humanity. Their lives are not valued in the plot the way the white woman's life is valued. This is tragically not much different than today in real life. Our society views black bodies as dangerous, and the killing of black people is given legal justification. The officer was scared. The unconscious or unexamined idea that black people are dangerous is part of the fabric of white supremacist culture. Now, of course, the white woman's life matters. the plot of the movie leads to her being rescued from her zombie state, which is good. No one wants her to stay a zombie. No one's challenging that, but no one ever questions the value of the white person's life. It's just a given. But the lives of countless brown and black people aren't given nearly the emotional or legal value at the societal level. And that is why the Black Lives Matter movement, or the movement for black lives, exists. So that they can say loudly and clearly, our lives are worthy of your tears. Our lives deserve to be protected under the law. You cannot use your unexamined bias as an excuse for why you kill us. The power of white supremacy controls us all. It is a system that steals from the souls of all of us, though not the bodies of all of us. It says white people cannot be held accountable for our actions because our biases are so strong. White supremacy is also tied to patriarchy and sexism. Along with the idea that men can't control themselves. Boys will be boys. Harassment is just a part of life for women and trans folks, and we shouldn't expect better. Enough of that. The Me Too campaign that is all over social media right now shows women and trans folks saying, "Me too, I have also been harassed or assaulted, and it's time for us to wake up. I have enough faith in the men that I know that they can do better, to expect better. It's insulting to assume that they are mindless idiots. A woman's body or clothing is not excuse for men's bad behavior." Similarly, white people can overcome our biases. We can become aware of the power of white supremacy that controls our world, and we can fight against it. We are not mindless idiots. And we can name it evil. At the beginning of this month, the first Sunday of Monster Month, we talked about evil and demons, and we learned that demons don't like to be called by name. This is white supremacy, and it's evil. And we don't have to be under its control anymore. We can wake up, and we must. Because if we don't wake up to these underlying structures of oppression, we will, against our will, continue to perpetuate them. And so in the spirit of this teaching, the religious educator inside me created something for you to take home and do. I didn't want to leave you with this sermon with a now what. So I want you to take a challenge. I'm going to ask you to say yes to this challenge verbally. The challenge is that for the next 5 weeks between now and Thanksgiving, that you will engage every day in a little intentional work around waking up from white supremacy. No matter where you are in your learning, whether today is the first time you've ever considered this idea, or whether you've been doing this work for a long time, we all can learn. And so I've adapted a calendar from a UU religious educator, Sarah Lewis, who serves the Olympia UU congregation in Washington. And I have printed out those calendars, and they are on a table, a tall table, right when you exit the sanctuary. And we will also share it in our weekly e-newsletter and on Facebook. I want you to take home one of the calendars, put it on your fridge or by your computer, or click on it in the e-news. And it has daily activities for you to do, like a video to watch, or an article to read, or an action to take. Writing or thinking prompts to move you forward in your work of waking up and taking back control from the evil powers of white supremacy. So what say you? Will you take the challenge?
Yes.
Great. So as we sang together this morning, "The road that I follow calls me on my way. Got my eyes on tomorrow and my feet on today." We can see the goal, but we can only do the work of today. Each day, every day, moving forward a little bit. And as we will hear in a moment, none of us are free until if one of us is chained. May it be so, and amen.